You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about new leadership at the American Constitution Society. It's a progressive group active on judicial nominations and the justice system. In a little over 3 years, President Trump has nominated and won Senate confirmation for 192 federal judges. And by the end of the year, based on current trends, a quarter of federal judges will be the president's appointees. What do you think of the direction that President Trump has led the federal court system and the Supreme Court? What are your thoughts on how the federal courts interpret the Constitution? Are they doing a good job? We're at 800-642-1234. Russ Feingold was a U.S. Senator representing Wisconsin from 1993 until 2011. He is the new president of the American Constitution Society. Senator Feingold, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's good to be on again.
Well, before we get to the American Constitution Society, let's spend a moment on COVID-19. You were the U.S. Special Envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa and the Democratic Republic of Congo from 2013 to 2015. And during that time, there was an Ebola outbreak in Congo. What did you learn from that about the best way to contain disease outbreaks?
Well, Lord knows I'm not an expert, but it is amazing if you think about both the HIV/AIDS virus and disease and the Ebola disease. Both of them really originated in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And in both cases, it related to connections with wild animals, particularly monkeys, and the role that bats play in interfacing with those animals, and the fact that people became exposed by people eating bush meat and so on. And this was how these horrific things apparently started. There's evidence that one of the possible causes of this problem in China was an animal that I was not even aware of called pangolin, which is something that is cooked and eaten from wild areas in China. And there is now an international ban on the sale of their scales and so on. So in all three cases, it appears that there is a connection between our getting closer to nature, some of these wild areas, not saying you should never do it, but that we don't necessarily understand the implications for human health with regard to it. So that's just one perspective. And having done this work in Africa and seeing this connection is not something I've heard people talking about. There is a connection between biodiversity and doing harm to biodiversity, as a group I'm working with called the Campaign for Nature is pointing out. There is a direct effect on human life. It's not just that certain species become extinct. It's that actually the interplay can be dangerous if it's not handled correctly. And I'm not a scientist, obviously, I'm not a doctor. It is possible that this relates to that kind of a situation as well.
Well, looking at Congress right now and the response to coronavirus, what can we learn from history as to how emergency legislation gets passed in Congress during a time of crisis?
Well, usually during the time that I was there, and although there were exceptions, when there was a catastrophe of some kind, usually after a hurricane or something, there was generally consensus and cooperation, and people put aside their partisan differences. Unfortunately, of course, this president thinks first about his own situation and then rather the national interest, but I think he's finally coming around to realizing that his own situation and the national interest might be linked. So there is some movement, but there are people apparently trying to even block the legislation that the president and the speaker agreed on. So that if there ever was a time to put aside the partisanship, it would seem to be now. It would almost seem to be insanity not to. So this is a real test of whether our system of government is going to work anymore. If people are crazy enough to play around with this virus for political reasons, there's a sense in which we've lost it.
We're talking with former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold. He is the new president of the American Constitution Society. You can join in with your questions about the work of the American Constitution Society at 800-642-1234. Senator Feingold, tell us about your new job as the head of this organization and what you intend to do.
Well, this is a major shift in topic. Challenging. Look, here's a big unseen sort of shrouded part of what's happening in this country with the rise of big money, corporate and personal interests trying to take over our government. You don't see this one as clearly as you do in the White House and Congress, and that's taking over the federal courts. Decades ago, very conservative, well-oiled interests came up with a plan to basically dominate the federal judiciary and to dominate our legal system, to turn it into a much different system in terms of the way in which the average person, a consumer, individual interfaces with the system. And their plan was, let's get a pipeline of as many possible very conservative young lawyers and get them ready to go on the courts at a young age, with, of course, the federal courts being life terms. So if you put somebody on the court at 35 or 40, there's a good chance that they'll be on there for 50 years. And that's exactly what these guys wanted to do.
And they're mostly guys, by the way.
Of course, they're mostly guys, and they're mostly white guys. And they're mostly people that have bought into what's called the Federalist Society's rather conservative and narrow agenda. So what happens is you have judges at the district level, the appellate level, and on the Supreme Court who take a very rigid view of the law. And that is almost always coming down in decisions that are for big corporations that not only might decide against the average person in court, but will maybe even deny them standing to bring a suit in court. In other words, to say you can't even be here, taking a very cramped and narrow view of the law. So, you know, people don't see this every day. It's a little more technical. But if people don't fight back, and this is what the American Constitution Society is all about, if we don't come back and say, wait a minute, we want fair-minded judges who will look at the case based on the parties and the facts in front of them. If we don't have that, our system of government is corrupted. And that is, in large part, what has happened by the capture of the courts by these very powerful interests. And it is a threat to every one of us. It's not just for the legal people that are involved in the legal system on a day-to-day basis. It's any time you interface with the court at a local level, if you're a small business, if you're somebody who's gone down to the police station for some reason, if you get arrested, whatever it is, if judges do not have a broad view that they are there to try to make the law work for the average citizen, then we have lost our way.
Well, let's take a call now. Yeah, let's take a call. Chris in Port Wing has a question. Hi, Chris.
Hi, and it's a pleasure to hear this very important subject. And thanks for being there, Senator Feingold. I wanted to ask if the senator felt that this was a very, very well-planned long-term effort, because I believe it started with the Obama administration's inability to seat judges due to the restraint put on by Mitch McConnell and the hard right leadership of the Senate. This has been going on for, you know, almost a decade now, and then the stacking and rapid deployment of these very hard right judges is something that's been an interesting plan to watch for a decade. And does he think that federal court term limits might be one remedy that the both sides could agree to?
Well, before we have former Senator Feingold respond to that, term limits, we have to pause right here. We're talking about the work of the American Constitution Society under its new president, former Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin. President Trump has made federal judgeship appointments at a rapid pace over the past 3 years. What do you think of the direction that President Trump has led the federal court system and the Supreme Court? Join in with your insights, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in a moment with more conversation with former Senator Feingold right here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at President Trump's efforts to reshape the federal judiciary. The president has appointed judges to the federal appeals courts at a record-setting pace. The American Constitution Society is trying to slow the trend. Have you been following who has been confirmed over the past several years? Has the U.S. court system become too politicized? And if so, how can the courts be protected from politicization? Join in 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold is the new president of the American Constitution Society, and he stays with us. So let's go back to Chris and Port Wing's question. Yes. He wanted to talk about the evolution of ideology on the judicial system, where you see it coming in previous decades, and also the possibility of term limits.
Well, first let me say, what a delight to get a call from Port Wing. I miss it up there, and I'm determined to get there this summer. But this was a great question. He got right to the core of the issue. The truth is that the right's effort to take over the courts, and by the way, the ACS is going to not just try to slow this trend. It's going to try to reverse the trend of the right wing taking over the courts. But having said that, they actually started this movement basically 40 years ago. I don't know if people remember, but Judge Bork was nominated by Reagan to go on the United States Supreme Court. And people like Ted Kennedy and others made sure that he did not get confirmed for the Supreme Court because of his extreme ideology and views on a number of subjects. Well, a lot of people in the conservative right became very angry about that and said, look, we need to come up with a movement. And this was the creation of the so-called Federalist Society, which very gradually, and frankly, a lot of people were asleep at the switch on the progressive side, very gradually managed to do this sort of takeover. And so the caller is right that an opportunity to at least slow this trend was missed under the Obama administration. But I don't say it harshly because, look what President Obama was trying to do. He was dealing with an enormous financial collapse, you know, the kind of thing we might be experiencing now, as well as his desire to finally get health care for all Americans after 70 years of frustration. Unfortunately, though, the opportunity to fill those judgeships with at least reasonable, hopefully progressive judges, instead of just the very conservative ones that George Bush was putting on there, the opportunity was lost. And frankly, it wasn't a high priority under the Clinton administration either. So ACS will be strongly advocating, should a Democrat be elected president, that this is a very high priority, that the openings that are available be filled as soon as possible. Because it's been very unfair in which Donald Trump has been able to jam through all these appointments, many of which should have been filled by President Obama, but they were blocked. This is critical.
Are these societies, Federalist and American Constitution, are they making it more likely that our federal courts will become more politicized?
No, because I'm afraid that Federal Society might look that way, but the American Constitution Society is nonpartisan. It doesn't believe you have to be a Democrat. It doesn't believe that you have to have certain views on certain issues. It doesn't have a narrow set of things in order to be a member in good standing. What it wants is members on the judiciary who act like judges, who have a judicial temperament, who believe that every litigant that comes before the court has a right to a fair hearing on their law and their facts. And this group is an attempt to get us back to the kind of courts that I grew up believing in Wisconsin and even at the federal level. And it used to be that even if a Republican president appointed somebody to the Supreme Court, that didn't mean they'd follow a narrow line. Justice Brennan, one of the great progressive justices of all time, was appointed by a Republican president, President Eisenhower. We need to get back to that, where you don't know in advance what a justice or a judge is going to rule. That's what the American Constitution Society believes in, and I think our society depends on a fair and independent judiciary, and I'm afraid the right doesn't really believe in that. They want to make sure that the economic agenda of the very well-heeled comes first, and that's what's happening.
Let's take a call. Gary in Boscobel. Gary, hi.
Good morning. Thank you, Senator, for your service on this issue. I think it's very important. And I have a question. I've watched the Republican Party cater to the wealthy and cater to the corporations and try to reduce or get rid of things that are good for the public, get rid of environmental protection bills and cut Social Security and health care, if there was no resistance to the Republicans, the conservatives, if they could have their way and do anything they want, what in the world is their ultimate agenda? Is it to control and turn the general public back into serfs that work on the landscape just to benefit the wealthy? I try to figure out what they really want, and I can't come to any kind of a conclusion about that. Could you answer that?
Well, I'm not the expert on what makes them tick, but I can tell you what the pattern is. Whenever they see something that gets in the way of making money, they try to take it apart. And that's environmental regulation, whether it's the clean water laws. You know, if they see money, you know, the fact that there's a lot of money in the healthcare system, of course there is. Well, they want to keep that in the private sector, in the insurance area, in the education. Instead of supporting public education that has been so beneficial to so many of us in Wisconsin over the years, they want to go with private school choice. So it's like if there's money to be made, and if it can be kept by those who already have a lot of resources, that appears to be their highest priority. So, look, I'm sure they have other motives, but that's the pattern.
We're talking
that's the pattern that they have applied to the judges who are making these decisions now.
We're talking with former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold, who is the new president of the American Constitution Society, looking at federal judgeships and the trends over the decades with various presidents. You can join in 800-642-1234. Senator Feingold, I understand you're reviving the American Constitution Society. How many members do you have, and how do you find recruits?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm reviving it. I said what I'm going to try to do is enhance its good work. There are already 200 chapters in 200 law schools, student chapters across the country. So most of the law schools, including University of Wisconsin-Madison and Marquette University Law School, where I've taught, there are over 50 chapters of lawyers across the country, not in every state, but in many of the states. And there are a lot of other individuals that are part of the larger organization. So it's basically the only sort of grassroots organization of progressive lawyers in the country. It's unusual that way. And, you know, of course, it varies from year to year because based on, you know, which students sign up. You know, so that if you're in a student chapter, you're a member for 2 or 3 years, and then the question is whether you join the lawyer chapter later. But overall, it's a darn good network across the country that I hope to expand.
So it's like a farm
team.
Yeah, like kind of like a farm team for young lawyer recruits moving up through the ranks?
I think that's a good way to describe it, and it needs to be even better at that.
When you look at the work of the Federalist Society, are you finding some good judges who are part of the Federalist Society, or do you see extreme partisanship?
Look, I'm not going to say that everybody that's been a member of the Federalist Society is not a good judge. That's not true. But there is a tendency of people that have that connection to have a very narrow ideology that usually favors very wealthy interests. So. I have appeared at Federal Society events. They are often excellent events where they have people like me as well as conservatives. So in that sense, it's positive. On the other hand, it appears that if somebody runs across, sort of indicates a viewpoint that is not consistent with their very narrow ideology on certain issues, that they aren't considered in good favor. You know, President Trump said, give me a list to the Federal Society of people that should be federal judges, and I'll go along with it. So he handed over his constitutional responsibility to make his own judgment about who would be the best judges to a group that has a very strict and narrow conservative ideology, and I think that's wrong. I think the Constitution says the president should look at all the people in the country who might be appropriate to be on a court, and the Senate should advise and consent. It shouldn't be handed over to some private group and say, you give us the list and we'll follow it. That's what they've done.
Before we run out of time, you've been critical of William Barr's Justice Department and said that the rule of law is under attack in our country. How do you see it under attack?
Well, it's under attack in every way. Not only what we've just talked about in terms of twisting the federal judiciary to a very narrow conservative agenda for the next 40 or 50 years, but directly attacking the legitimacy of the Justice Department, the President of the United States interfering, and the Attorney General going along, interfering with professionals about what sentencing recommendations should be. The attitude they had about the impeachment trial, where the Justice Department and others refused to cooperate with the House that made legitimate requests for testimony. In fact, the pardon power, the abuse of the pardon power that the Attorney General supported, where the President of the United States gave a list of pardons to people that did not deserve pardons, who had one thing in common: they were very well-to-do or they were famous. So just about every legal institution we have is under attack. The norms that have made us all feel like this could be a fair process that we could all rely on are being gutted, not only by the president, who obviously is doing it, but by one of the worst attorney generals in the history of this country. So yes, the rule of law is under severe attack, and American Constitution Society is going to do everything it can to restore those aspects of the system and to make sure the American people realize what happens when these norms are destroyed.
Thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold is the new president of the American Constitution Society. Coming up, more labs around the country are able to test for COVID-19, including the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. We talk with its assistant director of communicable diseases. What do you want to know about how testing is working right now? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll talk about it after this news update on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A quick heads up on our programming plans. We're expected to hear from the coronavirus task force briefing at 9:30 this morning, and we'll be carrying that briefing right here on the Ideas Network. That's coming up at 9:30. Right now, UW-Madison's Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene is taking in hundreds of coronavirus test specimens every day. The lab stayed open this past weekend, has more than tripled its capacity. Nationwide, as of this morning, almost 4,500 people have tested positive for COVID-19. Wisconsin yesterday reported 47 positive cases. Another 504 people have tested negative. Did you or someone you know get tested for COVID-19? How long did it take? When did you receive your results? What do you want to know about how the specimens are handled and what scientists are looking for? We're at 800-642-1234. Alan Bateman is Assistant Director of the Communicable Disease Division at the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. Alan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
So how are you keeping up with this demand of testing right now? What does your lab look like and feel like?
Yeah, things have definitely been busy. As of a week ago, we stated that we could relatively easily do 100 specimens per day. But since then, the number of specimens coming in has really ramped up a lot. So we are now a 7-day-per-week testing lab, and we've ramped up to be able to do 300 to 400 specimens a day.
Will you be able to go up any further with the staff you have right now?
So right now, staffing is not the main issue. We have a fantastic staff here that we're increasingly cross-training to be able to handle anything. It's really the reagents are a limiting factor right now, and we're looking to further increase the amount of specimens we can do per day as well.
How long does it take to test one specimen?
Great question. The current test we're using right now is the CDC-developed test. It's the same one that they've had since mid-January or so, and it takes around 1 to 2 days from the time that the specimen gets to us. And I want to be clear about that, because sometimes, depending on where it comes from in Wisconsin, it takes a while to get to us. It could be overnight transportation.
Is there a possibility for any false positives in this work?
We have very strict quality control, so we have known positive controls and known negative controls, and everything must pass before we release any results. And we have an entire quality management system to ensure the highest quality possible.
These scientists, they're working really rapidly to test these specimens that you're getting in. Are lab workers at risk for exposure? Are lab workers at risk for fatigue?
Yes, we're definitely, we always have the safety of our microbiologists very first as our top priority, and we meet the CDC's criteria for biosafety, and we actually exceed it as well by using enhanced protection for our lab workers. And in terms of fatigue, we are keeping a close eye on that as well. We're kind of shifting around some hours to be able to increase the capacity. But we do have a fantastic team of scientists here to be able to pitch in and help out with this effort.
How closely are you working with the CDC on this and how these test specimens are handled and the protocol for what happens after a test is completed?
Sure. So yes, CDC developed this test and then rolled it out to us. We've been running for about 2 weeks now with this test. So we've been in routine contact with CDC since they developed it back in January. And in terms of the test, once the result comes out, we have an electronic system that automatically sends the results both back to the original submitting lab or submitting clinic, as well as to public health, so they immediately know the results, positive or negative. And then if it is positive, we treat that as a critical result, it's called, and we call the people to let them know right away that it's positive.
Are these specimens then stored somewhere or destroyed?
We do save an aliquot for a while, just in case there's an error in the testing and we have to go back to it. But we do have to destroy some residual because we don't have space to keep every specimen from every test that we've ever done.
Well, let's take a call. Kelsey is joining us from Madison. Hi, Kelsey. What's your question?
Hi, thank you so much. I work in an assisted living facility that's connected to a skilled nursing facility. And I am also high risk as I'm on immunosuppressants, so the two communities that everyone's trying to protect, which I very much appreciate. My question is, would someone test positive for COVID-19 before they are symptomatic? And if so, wouldn't it be prudent to test these populations like us that have to stay in a community setting before we're symptomatic in hopes that we might separate those that are infected?
Hey, thanks for your question. That is a very good question. I don't think I am the best placed person to answer it. I'm primarily focused on the lab and the test itself. In terms of who gets tested and the situations under that, that is best for your clinician as well as the Public Health Department, Division of Public Health.
Kelsey, thank you for the call. So, Alan, the test itself and the protocols that came down from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on this test in January, is this testing pretty straightforward? Is this something that your scientists have seen before on what they need to do, what your microbiologists need to do in the lab?
It's, for us, it's relatively straightforward because we do this type of testing a lot, but we have highly trained and highly capable and experienced microbiologists here. This test is not like a pregnancy test where one stick is for one person for one result. There are many different supplies and reagents that go into the entire test system, and it is deemed a high complexity test by the federal regulators who regulate us.
Do you have enough supplies and reagents on hand?
We have enough supplies and reagents for a while, but that's one of the pinch points right now. And the supply chains are not super strong right now, so we need to make sure that we use the supplies and reagents that we have wisely for the most high-priority testing.
We're talking with Alan Bateman, Assistant Director of Communicable Disease Division at the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. Did you or someone you know get tested for coronavirus? How long did the process take? When did you receive your results? Did you know about the lab that processed it? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Now, Alan, you're not the only lab in Wisconsin that is doing this testing. Can you tell us about your network?
Absolutely. So we and the Milwaukee City Lab started at the same time about 2 weeks ago, and we also have connections with every clinical microbiology lab around the country or around the state, and those are the labs that are in hospitals and in clinics. And we've been working with a few of the larger of those labs as they develop their own tests. We were able to help them out by sharing our known positive and known negative specimens with them. And then we also, in about maybe a month or potentially two, a lot of the manufacturers will have approval for their tests and then be able to massively scale up and roll those out. And that's the rest of those, maybe 60 to 80 labs around the state that will then be able to test. And we will stay in contact with them as well. So right now we're at a handful of labs. That'll grow to a couple more larger labs over the next week or two. And then hopefully within a month or two, there will be a lot more testing availability.
So will the testing steps and the protocols within the labs be consistent around the state, or will different labs go about this testing in different ways?
Some of it will be consistent, but there will definitely be differences in the testing. So one of the tests that was just approved, I think yesterday, the company is called Hologic. That's a bit of a different type of test. So it is more automated and less manual, so the throughput could be a bit higher with that. And there are, in addition to that, different approaches that different companies are taking.
Well, when you say the throughput could be higher, explain what you mean.
The number of specimens tested in a given time can be higher because it doesn't take quite as many manual steps for people to do.
All right. So it could probably handle higher volume. Have you heard anything, or is your lab involved at all in this ability to do drive-up testing? What have you heard?
Yeah, so drive-up testing from the health system and the clinician's point of view definitely makes sense in what we've heard in terms of making sure that the sampling of patients who potentially have COVID is separated from hospitals and emergency departments so that transmission doesn't happen in those particular areas. In terms of the testing itself, the DHS, our partners, have recommended that it is recommended testing at commercial labs. There are large national commercial labs that are also online now. And one other thing with the drive-up testing, it's actually at this point drive-up sample collection, mm-hmm. and then that sample gets sent somewhere to a centralized lab, whether it's a national commercial lab or somewhere else for testing.
Do we have these large national commercial labs in Wisconsin, or where is the nearest one?
There are four main ones. Mayo is the closest to us in Rochester.
Uh-huh.
There's one called ARUP in Utah, and then there are two very large ones called Quest and LabCorp that have multiple different locations around the country.
When you look at the supplies and the reagents, are these supplies and reagents and that supply chain, is that domestic? Are these supplies coming from the U.S., or are you needing to get these from other countries?
That's a good question. I don't know offhand exactly if all of them come from the U.S. I think it would depend on the company and depend on the particular supply. The important thing for us is that we need each one of those supplies and reagents in order to do the test. So the best analogy I can think of is in baking cookies, where you need each of the ingredients. And if you don't have sugar, you can't make very good cookies. And if you don't have eggs, you also can't. So we need each of those ingredients to be able to do these tests and produce the results.
What about the cost? We're hearing that the cost will be waived for people who do need testing, who ultimately get tests. And I know you're in a lab situation, but what are the costs that are being incurred?
That's a good question. We have right now, we are doing fee-exempt testing. So at the state lab, it is fee-exempt. And typically what happens in emergencies like this is we are public health and we respond, and then we are reimbursed later at the state and or federal level. So we do not plan to have have people pay for this test under public health. If things go to a commercial lab or to another clinical lab, they may have their own payment structures.
We're talking about the lab testing for COVID-19 samples that is now a 7-day operation at the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. Alan Bateman is Assistant Director of the Communicable Disease Division. Have you been to a doctor recently for a respiratory illness? How did your health provider address your concerns? What do you want to know about how test samples are handled and the process of testing? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment with Alan Bateman here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're talking about the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene processing test specimens for COVID-19. The number of confirmed cases of the coronavirus in Wisconsin has reached 47, and the state hygiene lab is receiving several hundred lab specimens a day, ramping up testing to a 7-day-a-week operation, as we're learning. What do you want to know about turnaround time on test results and where specimens go? What do you want to know about the testing itself and the science involved in this, the microbiology? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Alan Bateman stays with us. He's Assistant Director of the Communicable Disease Division at the Wisconsin State Lab of Hygiene. Let's take another call now. Mary Kay is with us from Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I have three questions. The first one is, if you were to get a positive result on a test and you isolate yourself for 14 days, would you have an immunity to COVID? That's the first question.
Well, let Alan address the first question. What about immunity? Can you get COVID-19 again?
I think it's a little too early to know for sure. The science on this is rapidly evolving. Every day we learn more. And initially there were a few reports, I forget exactly where worldwide, that potentially people were positive and then tested negative and then tested positive again. But there have been some questions about if that negative in the middle was really true or if the person was positive the whole time. So I'd say at this point, it's not really known. But in general, there is some immunity, but with depending on the virus, that immunity can wane over time.
What if Mary Kay, just pause right here. I want to ask here, what have you learned from scientists in Italy and in China from their processing of tests?
We've learned that that automating things as much as possible and scaling up as much as possible is the goal, and that is exactly what we're doing. We're working daily to try to increase our capacity as much as possible. I think on the more public health side, we've definitely learned from China that the public health measures to keep people apart and attempt to stop transmission appear to have worked for now in China, which actually is really good news. And I think that's why similar things are being implemented now, both in Europe and in the U.S.
Let's bring Mary Kay back with a second question. Go ahead, Mary Kay.
If homes and businesses were to have those clean air machines with the filters that supposedly screen viruses, would that help?
Clean air machines, Alan?
That's a good question. I don't know offhand. It would depend on the filter. So inside the lab, we use biosafety cabinets, they're called, that have filters that can filter things out, like that are as small as viruses. But it would depend on the filter, and I wouldn't necessarily think that it would be a huge advantage to have those clean air machines. But I do not know at this point.
Mary Kay, thanks. Let's go to Matt now in Viroqua. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
What's your question?
So, yeah, my wife and I are avian testers for the state of Wisconsin and state of Minnesota. So we do tests for, you know, other diseases that are communicable in, livestock. But we've had trouble getting our reagent for, like, the last 18 months. So the state health departments have had trouble rolling that to us. Does that have any connection to kind of this supply problem that exists right now with COVID?
It may or may not. We haven't had a huge supply and reagent problem until recently, and I think that's because the huge demand has increased a lot, and that is from across the board. So all state health departments or state health labs, as well as a lot of the clinical labs and commercial labs, are all ordering similar things from manufacturers. And there are different manufacturers, but none of those manufacturers can immediately scale up to way more than usual. So that's why the supply chains currently are a little limited.
Matt, thanks. We're talking with Alan Bateman, Assistant Director of Communicable Disease Division at the Wisconsin State Lab of Hygiene. It's one of the facilities testing specimens for COVID-19. You're part of the discussion here, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about testing? Join in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We heard from Tim from Luck. Calden couldn't stay with us. Tim wonders if you had COVID-19 2 weeks ago, would you still test positive because there are antibodies that are still in your system?
That's a good question. And I would like to clarify that this test identifies the virus itself. So there are different types of tests, some that look for the virus and some that look for antibodies. And this one looks for the virus itself. So you could test positive a couple weeks after, but that would mean that the virus, or at least the virus's nucleic acid, the RNA, the genome part of the virus, is still around. People are developing antibody-based tests, and those will be very important in the future to see how many people truly are getting infected, because right now we know the people who have the virus, but we might be missing people who are asymptomatic or don't get tested.
Alan, help us understand how this virus morphs and changes. What do we know about its life cycle and how it can reinvent itself?
So most viruses, and particularly ones that have RNA and not DNA. So this one has RNA. They can mutate a little faster. So we're tracking that pretty closely. And so far, it seems like there actually hasn't been all that many mutations in the virus since it emerged from China. But there's a lot of recent technology in past years that have allowed very rapid sequencing, which is our ability to look at the virus's genome and to compare across all different viruses from around the world. And we're not seeing all that much variation yet.
Okay, so what's coming into your lab are pretty usual suspects here. You're seeing a lot of consistencies about your specimens.
Yes, so the viruses that have been sequenced worldwide are very similar to each other.
Okay.
And the specimens that we test seem to be pretty similar as well.
And the specimens, once again, they're coming to you from around Wisconsin. Are there any specimens coming from outside our state?
At this point, we're pretty sure it's just Wisconsin because each state has their own state lab.
Uh-huh.
And that's where this testing is happening at each state.
What is your toughest challenge right now, Alan? What are you grappling with?
Right now, it's the supply of the reagents and supplies that we're trying to look at larger platforms to be able to scale up. But as soon as we think about one platform, we contact that company and they say, yeah, sure, we can get your reagents in a month from now. So then that one's not an option. So we're looking at many different options, both with companies as well as we're in routine contact with the CDC, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, to be able to figure out how best to ramp up while we have this finite amount of supplies and reagents.
When was the last time you had to reassign your scientists in your lab to say, hey, we have an emergency here. We need you to come over and do this?
The last major time we did that was back in 2009 with the influenza pandemic. And the model there that we used of shifting people's hours around and cross-training people to be able to do the test. So we have more people than usual that are able to do the test. That worked really well then, and it seems to be working quite well right now as well.
So when you're cross-training people, that involves two people being together in a close proximity because they're working on the same specimen. Do you have concerns about that?
We are doing our best to keep people apart as much as possible, but there are times during the testing here where people can't stay exactly 6 feet apart, but we are doing our absolute best to do the social distancing while we do the important work, the necessary work that we need to do.
How often are you in contact with the CDC and new recommendations coming down for testing? What is communication like right now?
There's communication almost every day, both from CDC as well as our organization, APHL, the Association of Public Health Labs, and things are changing rapidly. Almost every day, things change in terms of what the guidance is, which specimen types we can use, how exactly to result things. So we really need to stay on top of everything that's moving, and it's a very rapidly evolving situation and continues to.
Well, Alan, thank you for making time for us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Alan Bateman is Assistant Director of the Communicable Disease Division at the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. A quick note on our programming. We are working to bring you more conversations about COVID-19. We want to answer your questions. You can always call during the live program, or you can leave us a message at any time of day at 833-424-3327. That number again, 833-424-3327. Be sure to mention your name and city, by the way, like Kate from Madison, so we can thank you on the air. Just ahead, we discuss coping mechanisms for dealing with the anxieties of isolation. We also talk about ways to stay connected with family and friends while practicing social distancing. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.